Stronger in there? Tails says loudly, looking toward Peter's office. Nervous about the game, then? Peter smiles. Did Da Vinci get a discount on Brown when he painted the Mona Lisa? Peter laughs and nods toward the office next to his. The president's bound to have a bottle or two. Tails brightens up. Peter calls after him. You are going to keep your shirt on today, aren't you, Tails? Not like the quarterfinal. The parents weren't happy. Promise! Tails lies, then adds quickly without turning around, as if it hadn't been his intention all along. Let's have a little glass together before the game, eh? I mean, I guess you could have water. Or soda, if that's what you drink. I've invited a few of the other sponsors along as well. I thought we could have a little chat. You know, off the record. He returns with both a bottle and the president, whose forehead is already as shiny as freshly polished ice, with dark patches under his armpits. Only then does Peter realize that he's walked into an ambush. Fatima has never been in the rink when there are so many people in it. She usually sees Ahmet's games with the boys' team, but those are only watched by the parents of the players and whatever younger siblings have been dragged along. Today, grown men are standing in the parking lot begging to buy tickets at four times their face value. Ahmet bought two well in advance. She had wondered why he didn't want to go with Zacharias like he usually does, but Ahmet had said he wanted to show her the boys he would one day be playing with. That was only a week or so ago, and back then it would have seemed utterly fantastical that such a day would come so soon. She clutches the tickets tightly in her hand and tries not to get in anyone's way in the throng, but evidently fails to be invisible because someone suddenly grabs her and says, "You, are you going to help with this or what?" Fatima turns around. Magan Lit is waving her arms at her, then points to a glass bottle that someone's dropped on the floor and has broken. "Can you get a dustpan and brush? Surely you can see that someone might step on it here. A child." The woman who dropped the bottle, Fatima recognizes her as the mother of another player on the team, is showing no sign of picking the glass up herself. She's already started to walk off to her place in the stands. "Are you listening or what?" Magan Lit exclaims, taking hold of Fatima's arm. Fatima nods and puts the tickets in her pocket. She goes to bend down by the glass. She is stopped by another hand on her shoulder. "Fatima?" Kira says warmly, before turning to Magan Lit with noticeably less warmth. "What's the problem?"
"I don't have a problem. She works here, doesn't she?"
Magan snarls.
"Not today,"
Kira says.
"What do you mean, not today? So what's she doing here, then?"
Fatima straightens her back and takes such a tiny step forward that it's unnoticed by everyone but her. Then she looks Magan in the eye and replies, "I'm not she. I am actually standing here. I'm here for the same reason as you, to watch my son play." Kira has never seen anyone more proud, and has never seen Magan so speechless. When the crowd has carried Mother Lit away, Kira picks the glass up from the floor. Fatima asks quietly, "Sorry, Kira, but I'm not used to... I wonder, would you mind if I sat next to you today?" Kira bites her lip, takes a firm grasp of Fatima's hand. "Oh, Fatima, I should be asking if I can sit next to you." Soon is sitting at the top of the stands. The sponsors who've passed him on the stairs have pretended they haven't seen him, so he knows precisely what they're on their way to talk about in the office. Oddly enough, he no longer feels angry or sad. He just feels tired of the politics and money and everything about the club that no longer has anything to do with hockey. He's just tired. So maybe they're right after all. He doesn't fit in anymore. He looks out across the ice and takes several deep breaths through his nose. A few of the players on the opposing team, ready early, the way you are when you're terrified, set out to warm up. No matter how times change, nerves remain the same. Soon finds that comforting, that this is still only a sport, regardless of what the men in the offices are trying to turn it into. A puck, two goals, hearts full of passion. Some people say hockey is like religion, but that's wrong. Hockey is like faith. Religion is something between you and other people. It's full of interpretations and theories and opinions. But faith, that's just between you and God. It's what you feel in your chest when the referee glides out to the center circle between two players, when you hear the sticks strike each other and see the black disc fall between them. Then it's just between you and Haki. Because cherry trees always smell of cherry trees, whereas money smells of nothing. David is standing in the players' tunnel, watching the sponsors go up the steps toward the offices. He knows what they say about him, how they talk about his successes. But he also knows how quickly they'd turn against him next year if the A-team doesn't reach the same heights. And dear God, does anyone in this town have any idea how utterly improbable this junior team is? There are no Cinderella stories in hockey anymore. The big clubs strip the smaller ones of talent before the players have even reached their teens. And even in Beartown, where, miraculously, all the guys have stayed put, there's only one player of truly elite caliber. The rest ought to be outplayed in 100 games out of 100. But despite that, here they are. This team is like a swarm of hornets. People keep asking what David's tactical secret is. He can't tell them because they wouldn't understand. The tactical secret is love. He became Kevin's coach when he was a frightened little 7-year-old who would have been flattened by the older kids outside the rink if he hadn't had Benji there to protect him. Even then, Benji was the most courageous little bastard David had ever seen, and Kevin the most talented. David taught them to skate backward as well as forward. He taught them that passes are just as important as shots. He made Benji play for entire practices without his stick, and forced Kevin to play for weeks with a stick that was curved wrong. But he also taught them that they only had each other, that the only person you can really trust in this world is the guy next to you on the ice, that the only people who will refuse to get on a bus before you come back to it are a team. It was David who taught the boys how to tape their sticks and sharpen their skates, but he also taught them how to knot a tie and shave. Well, their chins, anyway. They taught themselves the rest. He starts to laugh every time he remembers how Bobo, the wayward, hyperactive little fatty, once turned around in the locker room when he was 13 and asked Benji if they were supposed to shave their backsides at the same time as they shaved their testicles. Do girls think it's important that they match? When David himself was a junior, that was part of the younger player's initiation, forcibly shaving their pubic hair off. It used to be regarded as humiliating. He doesn't know what the modern equivalent would be, but he suspects that today's teenagers would only be scared by the prospect of being taped to a chair and having to let their pubes grow out again. Hockey changes all the time, because the people playing it do. When David was a junior, the coach used to demand total silence in the locker room. But David's team has always been full of laughter. He's always known that humor could bring people together, so when the guys were young and nervous, he always used to tell jokes just before a game. Their favorite when they were small was, "How do you sink a submarine from head? You swim down and knock on the door. How do you sink it a second time? You swim down and knock on the door," because then they open it and say, "Oh no, we're not falling for that again." When the guys grew older, their favorite was, "How do you know you're at a wedding in head? Because everyone's sitting on the same side of the church." Then they got old enough to tell their own jokes, and David used to leave the locker room more and more. Because sometimes the absence of the coach can also unite a team. He looks at the time, counting the minutes until the start of the game. The sponsors in the stands will never understand his tactics, because they can never understand what the guys on the team are ready to sacrifice for each other. While the sponsors have been shouting at David to let the team loose, offensively, David has patiently allocated very clear roles to his players, drilling them on where to pass the puck, on precise positioning, how to direct the play, angles, evaluation, and how to eliminate risk. He's taught them how to disarm any advantage their opponents may have in terms of technique or speed, how to bring them down to their own level, how to frustrate and irritate, because that's when they win, because they have something no one else has. Kevin. If he gets the chance, he can score 2 goals, and as long as he has Benji beside him, he'll always get at least 1 chance. "Ignore the stands. Ignore what people say," David keeps repeating. His tactics demand subordination, humility, and trust. 10 years of training and hard work. And if Beartown loses in every stat except the one indicating the number of goals scored, David will tell each and every one of the players in the locker room that they've done their job. And they trust him. They love him. When they were 7 years old, when everyone else just laughed, he told them he would take them all the way here. And he's kept his promise. Before he turns to go back to the locker room, he sees Soon sitting alone at the top of the stands. Their eyes meet for a moment. No matter how much they have argued, David knows that the stubborn old bastard is the only person in this club who actually still understands the love underpinning what they do. Chapter 17. Some people say that everything in hockey is black and white. They're crazy. Fatima and Kira are sitting in their seats when Kira suddenly excuses herself and stands up, makes her way to the steps, and stops a middle-aged man who Fatima knows is in middle management at the factory. Kira grabs at his red scarf irritably.
Kreister, for heaven's sake, take that off!
The man, who is obviously not used to being scolded, and certainly not by a woman, stares at her.
Are you serious?
Are you serious?
Kira exclaims, loud enough to make the other people on the steps turn toward them. The man looks around with uncertainty flaring on his cheeks. Everyone is looking at him. He doesn't know who it is, but behind him someone mutters, "For God's sake, Kreister, she's right." And then other voices soon join in. Kreister slowly removes his scarf and puts it in his pocket. His wife leans toward Kira apologetically and whispers,
"I tried to tell him, but you know what men are like. Sometimes they just don't understand hockey."
Kira laughs and goes and sits down next to Fatima again.
A red scarf! He must be mad! Sorry, what were we talking about?
Nothing is black and white in Beartown. It's red or green, and red is Head's color. Ahmet's fingertips trace the seams of his matched jersey. Dark green with silver numbers and the brown bear on the chest. The colors of Beartown: forest, ice, earth. He's wearing number 81. He was number 9 on the boys' team, but that's Kevin's number here. The locker room around him is chaotic. Benji, number 16, is of course lying in a corner, asleep as usual, but all the other juniors are sitting huddled up on their benches, forced back by parents who are getting louder and more excitable with their advice the closer the start of the game gets. That tendency exists in all sports. Parents always think their own expertise increases automatically as their child gets better at something, as if the reverse weren't actually the case. The noise level is unbearable, and loudest of all is Magan Lit, a privilege you can grant yourself when your son plays in the first line. Benji's mom has never set foot inside the locker room, and Kevin's mom hardly ever comes to the rink, so Magan has ruled the roost here for years. She came and untied little William's skates after every game until he was 13, and she and her husband sacrificed their second car and holidays abroad so they could afford to move into the house next to the Erdahl families, and their sons could become best friends. Her frustration at the fact that William hasn't yet managed to force his way in between Kevin and Benji has started to slip into downright aggression. When David walks in, the locker room explodes in a torrent of accusations, questions, and demands from all the adults in there. He walks straight through them as though they didn't exist, followed by Lars, who starts shepherding them toward the door. Magan Lit is so insulted that she bats his hand away.
"We're here to support the team!"
"That's what we have the stands for," David replies without looking at her. She loses control at that.
"And as for you, David, what sort of leadership are you showing, making changes to the team before this of all games?"
David raises his eyebrows uncomprehendingly at her. William Lit looks like he wants to die.
"What's he doing here?" Magan demands, pointing straight at Ahmet.
Ahmet looks like he shares William's wish. David keeps his voice quiet on purpose, forcing all the other adults to shut up. "I don't justify my choice of team to anyone." The vein on Magan's forehead is throbbing like a church bell.
"You'll justify it to me, I'll have you know. These boys have played for you for 10 years, and for their biggest game ever, you pick someone from the boys' team?"
She gestures expansively toward all the other adults in the room, and manages to get them to nod and grunt in agreement before fixing her eyes on David and demanding,
"Do you have any idea how important this game is for us? For all of us? Do you know what we've had to sacrifice for this sport?"
Ahmet is squirming, and looks like he'd like to run off down the hall, leave the rink, and never come back. That's not helped when David's face turns red so quickly that even Magan reverses straight into the wall.
"You want to talk to me about sacrifices?" David hisses, walking right up to her without giving her the slightest chance to reply.
"Look at him," he says, pointing at Ahmet. And before Magan has time to react, he's grabbed her by the arm and dragged her halfway across the floor until she's standing right in front of the boy. Look at him! Are you seriously standing here saying that your son deserves this more than he does? Are you saying they trod the same path to get here? Are you telling me your family has worked harder than he has? Look at him! Magan Lit's arm is shaking when he lets go of it. David simply gives Ahmet a quick pat on the shoulder. His thumb nudges the boy's neck, and he looks him in the eye. Not a word. Just that. Then the coach crosses the room, puts his hand on William Litt's cheek, and whispers, "We play for ourselves, William. No one else. You and I, we play for ourselves. Because we got ourselves here. No one else did." William nods and wipes his eyes. Bobo's feet are drumming the floor relentlessly. He's finding it impossible to sit still. When Lars throws out all the parents, including Magan, the silence is so intense that it's suffocating. And Bobo can't keep quiet in situations like that. He's never been able to. He isn't Kevin or Benji. He's always had to fight his way to the center of attention, to the middle of the locker room. As long as he can remember, he's been terrified of corners, of being forgotten, left unacknowledged. He can see all his best friends' heads hanging on their chests now, and he would desperately love to stand up and give an inspirational speech, the sort you see in films, but he doesn't have the words for it, nor the voice. He just wants to kill the silence. So he stands up, clears his throat, and says, "Hey guys, what did one lesbian vampire say to the other lesbian vampire?" The juniors look up at him in surprise. Bobo grins. "See you in a month." Some of the team start to laugh, which is all the encouragement Bobo needs to carry on. "Do you know what the usual cause of death is for lesbians?" A few more are laughing now. "Hairballs," Bobo cries before launching into his big finale. "And do you know why lesbians get so many colds? Lack of vitamin D." The whole locker room is laughing now. With him and at him, he doesn't care which. As long as they laugh. In a moment of pride, he turns to David, whose expression hasn't changed, and bursts out, "Have you got any good ones, coach?" The locker room falls silent again. David sits there motionless. Bobo's face turns first red, then white. In the end, Lars both saves and destroys him by clearing his throat, getting to his feet, and saying, "Do you know why Bobo always cries and his ears hurt after he's had sex?" Bobo squirms anxiously. Some of the guys start giggling in anticipation. Lars's face cracks into an alarmingly wide grin. "Because of the pepper spray and rape whistle." The storm of laughter from all the juniors makes the room shake. In the end, even David smiles, and he'll think back to that moment many times afterward, whether a joke is always only a joke, whether that particular one went too far, whether there are different rules inside and outside a locker room, whether it's acceptable to cross the line in order to defuse tension and get rid of nerves before a game, or if he should have stopped Lars and intervened by saying something to the guys. But he does nothing. Just lets them all laugh. He'll think about that when he gets home and looks his girlfriend in the eye. In the meantime, Ahmet is sitting in the corner, hearing himself laugh. Because it's a release. Because it makes him feel part of the team. Because there's something wonderful about making the same noise as everyone around him. He'll feel ashamed of that forever. Benji wakes up to find Kevin shaking him. Being able to sleep through both Magan Litt's tactical talk and Lars's sense of humor is one of his foremost talents, and getting a chance to do so is definitely a privilege. There have always been parents who have questioned Benji's behavior, both on and off the ice, but David always says the same thing. "If the other players gave me even an ounce of what Benji gives me on the ice every time, I wouldn't give a damn if they all slept on the team bench." When Bobo sits back down again, destroyed in the way that only a teenager can be by an adult in front of his best friends, another adult sits down next to him with his hand on his shoulder and his thumb against his neck. Bobo looks up. David is smiling at him. "You're the least selfish player I've got on this team, you know that?" Bobo presses his lips together. David leans closer to him. "You're going to be playing in the third defensive pair tonight, and I know that's going to be a disappointment to you." Bobo fights back tears. Throughout his early childhood, he was the best back in this team because of his size and strength,
but in the past few years his poor skating has let him down. First he slipped into the second defensive pair, now the third. David holds his hand gently on his neck and looks at him intently as he says, "But I need you. Your team needs you. You're important. So I want you to give me everything you've got tonight at every changeover. I want every last drop of blood. And if you give me that, if you trust me, I promise I'll never let you down." By the time David stands up, Bobo's feet are drumming against the floor again. If David had asked him to go out and kill someone at that moment, he would have done so without hesitation. When the coach stands in the middle of the room after 10 years with them, there isn't a boy in there who doesn't feel the same. He looks each of them in the eye in turn. "I'm not going to say much. You know who you're up against. I know you're better than them. So I expect just one thing. I will only tolerate one thing. Don't come back to this locker room until you've given it to me." He seeks out Kevin's gaze and holds it like a vice. "Win." "Win," Kevin replies with dark eyes. "Win," David repeats, punching his clenched fists in the air. "Win," the whole locker room roars with one voice. They fly up from their benches, a stamping, banging, panting horde, ready to be led out by their team captain. David walks past and slaps each of them hard on the helmet. Then when he gets to the front and has his fingers on the door handle, he whispers so that only boy number 9 can hear. "I'm proud of you, Kevin. No matter what happens this evening, if you play your best match ever or your worst, there isn't another player in the world I'd have picked over you." The door opens. Kevin doesn't walk out onto the ice. He takes it by storm. Chapter 18. Loneliness is an invisible ailment. Since Holger left her, Ramona has become like the animals in the wildlife documentaries she watches on the nature channels on the nights when the sleeping pills don't work. The ones who have been held in captivity for so long that you can remove all the barriers without them making any attempt to escape. Any living thing that is kept behind bars for long enough eventually becomes more scared of the unknown than its own captivity. At the start, she only stayed indoors because she could still hear his laughter in here, his voice, and the way he used to swear when he stubbed his toe on the low step behind the bar. A whole life together in this building, and he still couldn't figure out where that damn step was. But isolating yourself happens faster than you might think. The days blur together when you live more on the inside than outside, and the years continue to pass by on the other side of the street while she desperately tried to make everything inside the bearskin and the apartment above it carry on exactly as it was when he died. She was frightened she would forget him if she went out into the world, that she might go to the supermarket and come home to find that his laughter was no longer there. Then suddenly one morning, 11 years had passed, and everyone but her boys thinks she's lost her mind now. She became a time traveler trapped inside her own machine. People sometimes say that sorrow is mental, but longing is physical. One is a wound, the other an amputated limb, a withered petal compared to a snapped stem. Anything that grows closely enough to what it loves will eventually share the same roots. We can talk about loss, we can treat it and give it time, but biology still forces us to live according to certain rules. Plants that are split down the middle don't heal, they die. She is standing in the snow just outside the door, smoking. 3 in a row. The roof of the rink is visible from here. The roar when the Beartown Juniors make it 1-0 sounds like it's going to blow every building along the main street apart, as if it's going to pick the whole forest up and dump it in the lake. Ramona tries to take a step toward the street, just one step nearer the pavement. Her whole body is shaking uncontrollably as she fumbles for the wall behind her, sweat drenching her clothes in spite of the sub-zero temperature. She goes back into the warmth, closes the door, switches the lights off, and lies down on the floor in the bar with Holger's photograph in her hands, right next to the step. People say she's gone mad, because that's what people who know nothing about loneliness call it. Ahmet is terrified, even though he hasn't played for a second. When he followed Kevin and the rest of the team out onto the ice, when the crowd stood up and the roar made his ears pop, he headed straight for the bench, absolutely convinced he was about to throw up. One day he'll look back on that moment and realize that the feeling never disappears, no matter how successful you become. Kevin scores the first goal in the opening minute of the game. That's no coincidence. In every game, he seems to get a short window before the defense realizes just how good he is, exactly how fluid his wrist action, how swiftly he can skate around them. He does that with laser-like precision. They won't make that mistake again. For the rest of the game, they shut him down by shadowing him so closely they may as well be sharing the same pair of skates. The opposition turns the game around to 2-1. They deserve it. They're astonishingly good, powerfully and methodically mounting attack after attack until Ahmet ends up surprised that they're only leading by one goal every time he looks up at the scoreboard. They're the strongest and most technically proficient team he's seen. He's pretty sure they could have beaten Beartown's A-team. And everyone can see it. With every line change, the players around Ahmet slump more heavily on the bench. Their sticks pound the boards less often and less aggressively, and even Lars is swearing more quietly. In the second intermission, on his way to the locker room, Ahmet hears some adults in the stands laugh forlornly. "Well, a semifinal's nothing to be ashamed of. We'll just have to hope for a better team next season." He's surprised at how angry that makes him. It rouses something inside him. By the time he enters the room, he's ready to smash something. David is the only person who notices. Robbie Holtz is standing alone in the street, hating himself. He wouldn't have gone outside voluntarily today unless he'd run out of drink at home again. He looks at the roof of the rink, estimates in his head where they ought to be in the game now. It's a peculiar sort of angst, the one he lives with, knowing that you had the greatest moment in your life at the age of 17. While he was growing up, everyone kept telling him he was going to turn professional, and he believed them so intensely that when he didn't make it, he took it to mean that everyone else had let him down, as if somehow it wasn't his own fault. He wakes up in the mornings with the feeling that someone has stolen a better life from him, an unbearable phantom pain between what he should have been and what he actually became. Bitterness can be corrosive. It can rewrite your memories as if it were scrubbing a crime scene clean, until in the end you only remember what suits you of its causes. Robbie walks down the steps to the bearskin, but stops himself in surprise. The lights are off inside. Ramona is downing one last glass of whiskey and yanking on her outside clothes. "Good that you came," she whispers. "Why, are you going somewhere?" he wonders, confused, because he knows as well as everyone else that the crazy old bag hasn't been farther than a couple of paces from the pub in over a decade. "I'm going to a hockey match," she says. Robbie starts to laugh because there's no other option. "And you want me to mind the bar for you?" "I want you to come with me." He stops laughing then. She has to promise to wipe out his tab for the last 4 months to get him to take a single step outside the door. Tails is standing up even though he's paid for a seat. No one in the row behind can be bothered to complain anymore.
"That fucking William Litt, Christ, there are people in witness protection programs who are easier to find on the ice than that bastard," he snarls to the other sponsors.
"I beg your pardon?"
Mogan Litt exclaims from two rows below.
"I said witness protection program, Mogan,"
Tails repeats, and everyone sitting between them wishes they could apply to join it. Bobo is still sitting in complete silence on the bench when the third period begins, and he can count the number of minutes he's played on one hand. He doesn't know how you can be part of a team when you're not part of the game. He's trying to control himself, but he loves this team. He loves his jersey and his number. So when he sees something he can't believe everyone else can't see as well, he grabs hold of William Litt on the bench and shouts,
"Their backs want you to try to cut inside them, can't you see that? They want it to be so crowded in the center that Kevin doesn't have any space. Pretend you're heading in and then dart outside just once, and I promise you."
William clamps his glove over Bobo's mouth.
"Shut up, Bobo. Who do you think you are? You're in the third defensive pair. You don't tell the first line what to do. Go and get me my water bottle."
The look in his eyes is so cold and patronizing that Bobo can hardly hear the mocking laughter from the other players. The most painful fall for anyone is tumbling down through a hierarchy. Bobo has known Litt all his life, and the way his friend is looking at him now leaves marks and gives rise to the sort of corrosive bitterness that never leaves some men, that can wake you in the middle of the night and make you think someone has stolen the life you should have had. Bobo goes and gets the water bottle. Lit takes it without a word. Bobo is the largest player on the team, but when he sits down, he is the smallest player on the bench. Ramona stops outside the rink, stands in the snow shaking, and whispers,
I'm sorry, Robert, I can't, no farther than this.
Robbie is holding her hand. She's not supposed to be living this way. Holger ought to have been sitting in there. This should have been their moment. He puts his arm around her as only someone else who has been the victim of theft can.
Let's go back home, Ramona. It doesn't matter.
She shakes her head, fixes her eyes on him.
The deal is that I wipe your tab if you go to the game, Robert. I want to know what happened immediately afterward. I'll be standing here waiting.
Robbie is many things, but brave enough to argue with Ramona isn't one of them. There's a distinct moment in a player's life when they find out exactly how good they are. William Litz comes halfway through the third period. He's never been quick enough for this level, but now it also becomes clear that he doesn't have the stamina either. He can't keep up. He hasn't got the energy. Their opponents can direct him without going anywhere near him. Kevin has two men marking him, four arms across his chest, the whole time. Benji is a tornado, flying across the whole of the rink, but Beartown needs more space. Lit gives all he has.
It isn't enough.
David has built his whole philosophy, this team's entire unbelievable season, on not trusting to fate. They never just hope for the best. They don't just dump the puck forward and go for it. They have a plan, a strategy, a purpose with each pattern, each movement. But as soon, the old bastard keeps saying,
the puck doesn't just glide, it bounces as well.
It's unpredictable. Lit is heading for the bench when he gets tripped. He falls to the ice and sees the puck bounce over the blade of one of their opponents and nudges it forward out of reflex. It jumps over another three sticks. Kevin reaches for it but is brought down by a big hit. There's no way for anyone to get around the falling bodies, but as luck would have it, Benjamin Ovich isn't a go-around person. He's a go-through person. When the puck flies into the goal, Benji isn't far behind it, and the crossbar hits him across the neck. You couldn't have gotten him to admit that it hurt, even if it had been a medieval broadsword. 2-2. Magan Litt is already down banging on the door to the scorekeeper's cubicle to make sure that William is credited with the assist. David nods silently to himself and taps Amit's helmet. Lars's pupils widen in pure disbelief when he realizes what's going on.
For God's sake, David, you can't be serious!
David is as serious as a stray bullet. Litt is one change away from needing oxygen and two from needing a priest. We need pace.
Lit just made an assist!
He was lucky. We don't play on luck.
Amit!
Amit just stares at the coach. David grabs hold of his helmet.
At the next face-off in our zone, I want you to take off. I don't give a shit if you've got the puck or not. I just want them to know how fast you are.
He points toward their opponent's bench. Amit nods hesitantly. David doesn't break eye contact.
Do you want to be something, Amit? Do you really want to show this whole town that you can be something? Now's your chance to show them.
At the next defensive face-off, Benji lines up on one side of Kevin, Amit on the other. Magan Litt is now standing with both hands against the glass of the team bench, shrieking that no one pulls her son from a semifinal and goes unpunished. Lars looks at David.
If we lose this game, she's going to castrate you.
David leans nonchalantly against the boards. Winners have a tendency to be forgiven in this town. Out on the ice, Benji does as he's been instructed. He gets the puck and fires it out of the zone, and it glides toward the opposing team's end. Amit does as he's been instructed. He takes off. He gets hacked by one of the backs as he's only just starting to skate away, and by the time he pulls free, there's no point chasing the puck. He goes after it anyway. A gasp runs through the spectators who understand hockey. A deep sigh passes through the ones who don't. The opponent's goalie calmly skates out and plays the puck to his defense, who move it up the ice, where their forwards fire a shot at Beartown's goal. When the referee blows for another face-off back in Beartown's end,
Amit is standing alone in the opposing team's zone, 200 feet away. The other sponsors are muttering, "Does that one need a compass or what?" But Tails can see what David sees, what Soon saw. "Quick as a wolverine with mustard up its ass. They won't catch him," he smiles. David leans over the boards and catches Amit by the shoulder when he's on his way back. "Again." Amit nods. Kevin wins the face-off, but Benji doesn't even manage to get the puck out of the zone, but Amit sets off at full speed toward the opponent's goal anyway, and doesn't stop until he reaches the boards at the far end. He can hear booing and mocking laughter from the stands. "Are you lost? The puck isn't anywhere near you!" But he just looks at David. The Beartown goalie smothers the puck, another face-off. David makes a brief circular gesture in the air. Again. The third time Amit races across the ice, it doesn't matter where the puck is, because there's one person in the rink who sees his pace and realizes what's going on. The coach of the opposing team snatches a sheaf of papers from his assistant and roars, "Who the hell is that? Who the hell is number 81? Amit looks up at the stands. Maya is on the steps just below the cafeteria. She sees him. He's been longing for that since the first day in primary school, and now she sees him. He loses his concentration so much that he doesn't hear Bobo yelling his name until he's right next to the bench. "Amit!" Bobo is hanging over the boards and grabs him by the collar. "Fake inside, skate outside!" For half a second, they look each other right in the eye, and Bobo doesn't need to say anything to prove how much he would have liked to be on the ice himself. Amit nods in acknowledgement, and they tap each other's helmets. Maya is still standing on the stairs. At the next face-off, Kevin and Benji circle the zone, stop in front of Amit, and lean toward him. "Have you got any strength left in those little chicken legs, then?" Kevin grins. "Give me the puck and you'll see," Amit replies with bloodshot eyes. Kevin wouldn't have lost that face-off even if his hands had been tied behind his back and he had a pistol held to his head. Benji shovels the puck along the boards and chases after it. Tomorrow his thighs won't even let him get out of bed, but he feels nothing now and knocks down two opponents with one hit. Amit faints inside but chips the puck off the boards instead, then blasts past the defenseman on the outside so quickly that one of the two players covering Kevin has to let go of number 9 and chase number 81 instead. That's all Beartown needs. A stick hits Amit's lower arm so hard that he thinks his wrist is broken, but he manages to pull the puck from the boards and skate around the net. He has one breath in which to look up, wait until the blade of Kevin's stick hits the ice, then release the puck at the same instant he's knocked to the ice. Kevin gets the puck 2 inches off the ice, and that's twice as much as he needs. When the red light goes on behind the net, adults tumble over each other in the stands. The sponsors send each other's cups of coffee flying across the rows of seats as they try to do high fives. 2 15-year-old girls bounce around a cafeteria in delight, and up at the back of the stands, an old A-team coach who never laughs does so today. Fatima and Kira hug each other until they're lying on the floor and aren't really sure if they're celebrating or crying. Outside the rink, alone in the snow, Ramona stands and feels the sound wave hit her. "I love you," she whispers to Holger. Then she turns and walks home on her own with a smile in her chest. It is a moment shared between people and hockey, between a town whose inhabitants want to believe and a world that has spent years telling them to give up. There isn't a single atheist in the whole building. Kevin turns and heads straight for the bench, swatting away every teammate who tries to hug him, climbs over the boards, and throws himself in David's arms. "For you," the boy whispers, and David holds him like he was his own son. 20 yards away, Amit crawls to his feet from the ice. He might as well be in a different rink altogether, seeing as no one is looking at him anyway. A moment after his pass, the defenseman's stick and elbow hit him in the neck with all his weight behind them. Amit's head hit the ice as if he'd been knocked into an empty swimming pool, and he didn't even see the goal. By the time he gets to his knees, every Beartown player is following Kevin toward the bench. Everyone in the stands is watching number 9, even Maya. Number 81, the number he chose because his mother was born that year, stands alone by the boards and looks at the scoreboard.
It is simultaneously the best and worst moment he has experienced in this rink. He adjusts his helmet and skates toward the bench in a few lonely strides, but someone swings around behind him and taps him twice on the helmet. "She'll notice you when we win the final," Benji smiles. He's already skated off and is standing by the center line before Amit has time to reply. Lit is on his way over the boards, but David stops him and calls to Amit to stay on the ice. As Kevin skates out to take the face-off at center ice, they nod briefly to each other, number 9 and number 81. Amit is one of them now. It doesn't matter how many people up in the stands actually realize that. Peter loses his bearings after the final whistle. One moment he's bellowing in an embrace, the next he's tumbling headfirst down an entire section of the stands, and gets to his feet with his ears ringing from all the people shrieking in and around them. Old people, young people, people who love this game, and people who don't even care. He has no idea how it happened, but all of a sudden he finds himself in the middle of a wild, singing embrace with a stranger, and when he looks up, he realizes that the man he's dancing with on the steps is Robbie Holtz. They stop and look at each other, then start laughing and can't stop. For this one evening, they're 17 years old again. Hockey is just a silly little game. We devote year after year after year to it without ever really hoping to get anything in return. We burn and bleed and cry, fully aware that the most the sport can give us in the very best scenario is incomprehensibly meager and worthless. Just a few isolated moments of transcendence. That's all. But what the hell else is life made of? Chapter 19. Adrenaline does strange things to the body. When the final signal sounds, it makes moms and dads jump over the boards, respected entrepreneurs and factory managers slide around on the ice on slippery shoes, hugging each other like overtired toddlers in diapers. When Kevin drapes himself and Benji in a huge green flag and starts skating a lap of honor, the stands are already pretty much empty. The rink has filled up with the entire community. Everywhere people are jumping, slipping, tumbling, laughing, celebrating, crying. Childhood friends, classmates, parents, siblings, relatives, neighbors. How long will the town remember this? Only forever. When you lose in hockey, it feels like having your heart scalded. When you win, you own the clouds. Beartown is a heavenly town this evening. Peter stops by the boards in one corner. He sits down alone on the ice and just laughs. All those hours in the office, all the arguments, the sleepless nights and angst-ridden mornings, they're all worth it now, every last one of them. He's still sitting there when the rest of the town, one inhabitant at a time, leaves the ice. Robbie Holtz comes and sits down next to him. They just grin. Adrenaline does strange things, especially when it leaves you. When he was a player, Peter kept getting told how important it was to control your adrenaline, but he never understood that. For him, his complete unquestioned focus and concentration out on the ice, his ability to live absolutely in the moment, came quite naturally. It was only when he had to watch a game from the stands for the first time that he realized how close adrenaline is to panic. What rouses the body to battle and achievement are the same instincts that instill mortal dread in the brain. During his career as a player, Peter used to think of the final signal at the end of the game as a roller coaster that's come to a halt. Some people think, good, that's over. And some think, again. His first wish after every game was always to be allowed to play another one. Now, as GM, he needs migraine pills just to be able to function normally afterward. When the last supporters, parents, and sponsors, delirious with victory, finally leave the rink over an hour later and spill out across the parking lot, chanting, "We are the Bears! We are the Bears! We are the Bears! The Bears from Beartown!" Peter, Robbie, and their memories stay behind. "Do you want to come up to the office?" Peter asks, and Robbie bursts out laughing. "Bloody hell, Peter, this is our first date. I'm not that kind of girl." Peter laughs too. "Sure, we can have some tea and look at old team photos." Robbie holds out his hand. "Say hi to your lads for me, okay?"
Tell them a proud old soldier was here watching them this evening.
Peter squeezes his hand.
Drop around for dinner one evening. Kira would love to see you, too.
Sure, Robbie lies, and they both know it.
They part. We only get moments.
The locker room is empty.
After the adrenaline, after the singing and dancing and jumping on benches and banging on walls, after having just been packed with young and old men alike, with bare chests and beer in their hair, it's now numbingly silent.
Ahmet is the only one left. He's going around picking up scraps of tape from the floor.
Peter walks down the corridor and stops in surprise.
What are you still doing here, Ahmet?
The boy reddens. Don't say anything, okay? About me doing a bit of tidying up. I just want to deal with the worst of it.
Peter's throat starts to tighten with shame. He remembers when he used to see the boy collect empty cans from the stand so that Fatima could afford to buy hockey gear for him for the first time when he was 8 or 9 years old. They were too proud to accept charity, so Peter and Kira had to place fake adverts in the local paper so that every year some cheap second-hand equipment in Ahmet's size would just happen to show up. Kira built up a network of people all the way to head who took turns pretending to be the sellers.
No, no, of course not. Ahmet, it would never even occur to me to say anything to the other players, he mumbles.
Ahmet looks up, baffled, then he snorts.
The players? I don't give a shit what you say to the players. Don't say anything to Mom. She gets really pissed off if I do her job.
Peter wishes he could say something to the boy just then. Something about how incredibly proud he made him out on the ice that evening. But he lacks the words for that. He doesn't know how to go about it. And feels like a bad actor when he does try. Sometimes he gets so envious of David's ability to make these young guys love him that it drives him mad. They trust David, they follow him, worship him. Peter feels like a forlorn parent at the playground watching some jokey mom or dad farther away who manages to get all the kids roaring with laughter. So he says none of the things he'd like to say to Ahmet. Just smiles and nods and manages to say,
"You must be the only teenager in the world who gets told off by his mom for cleaning too much."
Ahmet hands him a grown man's shirt. One of the sponsors left this. It smells of alcohol. Peter slowly shakes his head.
Look, Ahmet, I...
Words fail him. All that comes out is, "I think you should go out into the parking lot. You've never gone out of this rink after a match like this. I think you should. It's quite an experience, one not many people get to have. You can walk through that door as a winner."
Ahmet doesn't really understand what that means until he actually packs his equipment away, heads out into the corridor, and pushes through the outside door.
Grown-ups cheer and applaud when they see him. A few of the older girls from school shout his name, Bobo gives him a hug, Benji ruffles his hair, and everyone wants to shake his hand. Farther away, he can see Kevin being interviewed by the local paper. Then he writes autographs for a sea of children while their mothers nag him to let them take 2 photographs each. One of Kevin and the child, and one of Kevin and the mother. Ahmet bounces around between the hugs and pats on the back, and hears himself join in a shouted rendition of "We Are the Bears from Beartown," so loudly that his chest stings, and he hears the others singing louder because he does, because they want to feel that they're participating in what he represents now. The rush lifts him up, his endorphins are bubbling, and afterward he will remember thinking, "How can anyone possibly experience this without thinking he's a god?" Kira's cleaning the cafeteria. Maya and Anna emerge from the washroom. They've changed and put on makeup and are full of laughter and expectation.
I'll be staying at Anna's tonight. We're going to study, Maya smiles.
Her daughter is lying, of course, and her mother is lying when she pretends not to understand that. They're balancing on that defining moment in life when they're each equally concerned about the other. The teenage years offer a brief period of equality after childhood, before the balance shifts and Maya becomes old enough to worry about her parents more than they do about her. Soon Maya won't be Kira's little girl anymore, and then Kira will become Maya's little old mom. It doesn't take a lot to be able to let go of your child. It takes everything. Peter steps into the president's office. It's full of grown men stumbling about, already very,
very drunk.
That's what I've been looking for! Tails yells, and comes staggering toward Peter, bare-chested, and grabs his shirt from Peter's hand. Peter glares at him. I never want to hear that you've taken alcohol into the players' locker room again. They're kids, Tails.
Pah, they're not kids, Peter. Give it a rest. Let the boys celebrate.
I let the boys celebrate. I just think that grown men ought to have their limits. Tails waves his words away as if they were persistent little insects. Two men behind him, clutching cans of beer, are engaged in a heated debate about the club's 18 players. One forward is described as so fucking thick he can't even go and buy a loaf of bread without someone to hold his hand. A goalie is soft in the head. You can tell because he married a woman everyone knows slept with half the team before him, and probably the other half afterward. Peter isn't sure if the men are sponsors or just part of Tails' group, but he's heard remarks like that 1,000 times and still hasn't gotten used to the hierarchy in these rooms. The players can talk crap about the referee, but never the coach. The coach can criticize the players, but never the GM. The GM can't criticize the president. The president can't criticize the board. The board can't criticize the sponsors. And at the very top are the men in suits in this office, talking shamelessly about the players as if they were racehorses. Products. Tails tweaks Peter's ear affectionately to lighten the mood.
Don't sulk now, Peter. This is your night. Do you remember 10 years ago when you said you were going to develop our youth program? When you said that one day we'd have a junior team that could hold their own against the best in the country? We laughed at you then. Everyone laughed at you. And now here we are. This is your night, Peter. You made this happen.
Peter wriggles out of the headlock. Tails, drunk and happy, tries to get him in. The other sponsors start loudly comparing scars and capped teeth, trophies from their own hockey-playing days. None of them asks Peter about his. He has no scars. He never lost any teeth, never got into any fights. He has never been a violent man. One board member, a beer-sodden director of a ventilation company in his 60s, starts bouncing about and slapping Peter on the back as he grins.
Tails and I met our local counselors. They were here this evening, and off the record I can say that things look pretty damn promising for your new espresso machine.
Peter sighs and excuses himself, then goes out into the hallway. When he sees David, he actually feels relieved, even though the junior coach's constantly supercilious attitude normally drives him mad, because right now he's the only sober person in the vicinity.
David,
he cries. David carries on without so much as glancing at him. Peter jogs after him.
David, where are you going?
I'm going to watch the video of the game, the coach replies mechanically. Peter laughs.
Aren't you going to celebrate?
I'll celebrate when we've won the final. That's why you appointed me. To win that. His arrogance is even more pronounced than usual. Peter sighs and sticks his hands forlornly in his pockets.
David, come on now.
I know the two of us don't always see eye to eye on everything, but this is your victory. You've earned it. David's eyes narrow, and he nods toward the office full of sponsors and says, No, Peter. Like everyone in there keeps saying, this is your night. After all, you're the star on this team, aren't you? You always have been. Peter stands rooted to the spot with a growing dark cloud in his stomach, unsure if it's made up mostly of shame or fury. His voice sounds angrier than it should be when he calls after David.
I only wanted to congratulate you.
David turns around with a bitter little laugh. You should congratulate Soon instead. He was the one who predicted that you and I could do this. Peter clears his throat. I couldn't find him in the stands. David holds Peter's gaze until Peter looks down. David nods sadly. He was sitting in his usual place. You know that. Peter swears under his breath and turns away. David's words creep after him. I know what we're doing here, Peter. I'm not some naive little kid. I'll be getting Soon's job because the time has come, because I've earned it, and I know that makes me a bastard. But don't forget who's holding the door open for him. Don't try to kid yourself that this isn't your decision. Peter spins around, fists clenched. Be careful what you say, David. David doesn't back down. Or what? You'll hit me? Peter's chin is trembling. David stands motionless. In the end, David snorts derisively.
He has a long scar across his chin and another between his chin and cheek. No, I thought not. Because you're Peter Anderson. You always let others take penalty suspensions for you. David doesn't even slam the door behind him when he goes into his office. He just closes it silently. Peter hates him for that more than anything. Because he's right. Kevin looks completely unmoved when he's being interviewed by the journalist from the local paper. Other boys his age would go to pieces with nerves, but he's calm and professional. He looks at the reporter's face, but never in the eye. He fixes his gaze on her forehead or the top of her nose. He's relaxed, but not nonchalant. He's not unpleasant, but not pleasant either, and he answers all her questions without saying anything at all. When she asks about the game, he mutters that it's all about doing a lot of skating, getting the puck in the net, creating chances. When she asks what he thinks victory in the final would mean for the town and the people here, he repeats like a machine, "We're taking each game as it comes, concentrating on the hockey." When she points out that one of the opponents checked by his teammate Benjamin Ovitch toward the end of the game was left concussed, Kevin claims without blinking, "I didn't see that incident." He's 17 years old and already as media savvy as a politician. The crowd carries him away before the reporter has time to ask anything else. Amit finds his mother in the crowd and kisses her on the forehead. She merely whispers, "Go, go," with tears in her eyes. He laughs and hugs her and promises not to be late home. She knows he's not telling the truth, and it makes her so happy. Zacharias is standing at the far end of the parking lot, in the outermost circle of popularity, while his best friend is in the innermost circle for the first time. The adults get in their cars and drive off, leaving the youngsters to enjoy the biggest night ever, and when the stream of players and girls starts to move off toward the party that almost all of them are going to, it becomes painfully obvious who belongs and who's going to be left behind. Zacharias will never ask Ahmet if he forgot about him or simply didn't care. But one of them goes, and one stays behind. And nothing will ever be quite the same again. Peter bumps into Maya and Anna when he's on his way to the cafeteria. To his surprise, his daughter throws her arms around his neck, the way she used to every day when he came home back when she was 5 years old. "I'm so proud of you, Dad," she whispers. Rarely has he let go of her more reluctantly. Once the girls have rushed down the stairs laughing, the entire rink falls silent. A silence only broken by his own breathing, followed by his wife's voice. "Is it my turn now, superstar?" Kira calls. Peter's face breaks into a melancholic smile and he walks toward her. Gently they take hold of each other's hands and dance slowly. Slowly, in tiny, tiny circles, until Kira takes his face in her hands and kisses him so hard that he gets embarrassed. She can still do that to him. "You don't look as happy as you should," she whispers. "Oh, I am," he ventures. "Is it to do with soon?" He hides his face against her neck. The sponsors want to go public with the news about David taking over after the final. And they want to force Soon to hand in his notice voluntarily. They think it'll look bad in the media if he gets fired. "It's not your fault, darling. You can't save everyone. You can't carry the weight of the whole world." He doesn't answer. She tickles his hair and smiles. "Did you see your daughter? She's going to go back to Anna's to study." "Quite a lot of makeup for solving equations, eh?" Peter mutters. "The hardest thing about trusting teenagers is the fact that we used to be teenagers ourselves. I can remember when some boy and I were..." "I don't want to hear this." "Don't be ridiculous, darling. I did have a life before I met you." "No!" He sweeps her up off the floor and into his arms, and all the air goes out of her. He can still do that to her. They giggle like a couple of kids. Through the window of the cafeteria, they see Maya and Anna go off down the road with the hockey players and their school friends. The temperature is falling rapidly in the darkness, and snow is swirling around the girls' bodies. There's a storm brewing. Chapter 20. The windows of the Erdahl family house are rattling from overstrained loudspeakers. The ground floor fills with bodies at the same rate as if they were being thrown in through a hole in the ceiling. Most of the players are already hopelessly hammered, and the majority of the other guests aren't far behind. They aren't novices when it comes to parent